Wait a minute, this sounds like rock and or roll.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and on today's episode, you're going to get to hear an interview I did with guitar player, singer, songwriter Lee Hart about his very cool decades-long career in rock and roll, going back to the 70s with bands like Slowbone and the Roll-Ups, into the 80s with his band Yah Yah, and then he replaced Dave King in Fastway for a couple of albums, and then in the early 90s, he had a couple of really cool solo albums, and then mid-90s, there was an album that came out. It was called D-Rocks. The group was called D-Rocks. We talk about that, and about how Lee actually had nothing to do with naming it D-Rocks, but it was just a Lee Hart album, and whoever owned it put it out as D-Rocks, and we talk about that. All these records, all these bands, very cool songs, so all the way through his whole career, very cool stuff, so... And he's got a great story to tell, so let's get to it. We're going to start off with a song by Slowbone, Lee's band from the 70s, called Get What You're Given, and then we'll go right into the interview I did with Lee Hart. So, well, how did it all start for you, music-wise, like, when you were young?
I'll try and compress it, because it'll be long. You'll need about 6 episodes to get a story. So, to compress it, I don't know. Yeah, I come from a musical family, but, you know, when I was a kid, there was no money for music lessons or for instruments. So, I just used to mess around on my grandma's piano when I was 8 years old. Didn't have anyone to teach me, and I kind of worked out what to do with the piano, but I really wanted to play guitar, and it's the nearest thing I could get because it was free and it was in a living room. So started out on the piano, got to the grand old age of 10 9 10, told my dad I really wanted a guitar. He went out and bought me a banjo thinking it was a guitar. So I had to start my rock career on a banjo, which, you know, wasn't too cool in front of everyone. You know, the kids that already had the guitars there. So,
yeah.
And it was a 5-string as well. And, you know, they all said, you've got a string missing. And at that time, it was kind of hard to explain, well, I got this by mistake.
Yeah.
So it started out on the banjo. And eventually, when I got a bit of money through, you know, doing kids, you know, Saturday jobs and things, I managed to save up my first guitar. Progressed from there, and I think I played my first live show in front of an audience when I was 11 and a half. Wow. I just went on to do so many things. I was primarily a guitarist in the early days of my career, not really a singer. And any time I wanted to do anything, I could never find a singer, and I'd end up having to sing because I could never find, you know, the right singer. So had to learn to sing whilst playing guitar, and that's where the singing came in. I played in so many bands, I can't bloody remember which one's which.
Well, I think the earliest band name I've seen is Turquoise. Was like a psychedelic band, supposedly.
Turquoise. Yeah, we were managed by the Rolling Stones Limited. Yeah, I remember that in Maddox Street. Now, a couple before that, a band called the Peeping Toms.
Okay.
I think I was 13 in that, and a band called the Sapphires when I was 11. But I suppose the first band, yeah, that really had the record deal and everything like that, had all the connections, was Turquoise. Then I went on to a band called the remnants of that was My Cake, which probably no one's ever heard of, but I remember that was the first band that I really toured with, a three-piece band, and we were supporting everyone from Deep Purple to Black Sabbath, you name it, everybody on the circuit.
Wow.
And then from that
band...
And
was this like late 60s or early 70s?
No, that was the 70s. That would have been 70... God, I can't remember. Give my age away now. That'd be 90, 70-something, and then did the rounds with My Cake, and that progressed into Slowbone, eventually, with another member making it a four-piece.
Right.
And that was really the first band that made an impact, and kind of, I mean, Slowbone were on the scene, you know, I managed Paul Di'Anno for quite a lot of years, but before I managed him, we were, you know, competition to each other, because he was in Maiden, and I was in Slowbone.
Right.
And doing the same kind of circuit. So, yeah, that was the circuit. Same thing again, you know, I was primarily a hard rock come metal guitarist and kept trying to get singers in. We could never get the right singer, so I'd always end up with the singing duties as well.
Maiden formed in what, 75, was it? Or 76? Or was it
around about 75, 76, I think. But that wasn't with Paul. That was with they had a couple of other singers before
right.
Paul, didn't they?
Right.
Yeah. And around about that time.
Slowbone, you had some singles on major labels in like 74. Were they all in 74? Were there three of them?
Do you know, I don't know. I mean, yeah. the thing about that band was we had this massive, massive London following and a little bit in the suburbs as well. But every time we'd get to meet someone that was supposedly going to take us on to better things, they'd always say, you've got to change this and you've got to change that. Now, we were young, we didn't know, but we'd always listen. If they say, well, you've got to look this way or do that, we'd do it. So we changed and we did so many different things that we didn't either didn't want to do or we didn't know whether it was the right thing to do. But we released record after record and... Just did everything. Changed the name round to all different versions of the name. Just doing what we were told. And
there was a single called "Hot California Beach" where you were called the Rough Riders.
Yeah, and I won't go in again. I don't want to name any and shame anyone, but I remember. Yeah, we were pretty green. I suppose that means the same in America, isn't it?
Yeah,
We were really green. We were grass, practically. Yeah, and I remember we got. So many record deals, but then we got one really big record deal with some big people behind us, and we were in recording our album, or about to be called, but I don't want to use any names, and the person that was producing the album flew his tambourine on our bill via Concorde, because he wanted it fast in the UK. He flew this bloody tambourine, said it's a special tambourine that had been on a lot of hit records. He flew it from America, from New York to London on Concorde, so it'd be there right away. And you know, and I didn't know. I was saying, who's paying for all this? And they said, oh, you are. I said, but I haven't got any money. They said, but, yeah, it's going on your bill. I mean, what do you mean it's going on my bill? I didn't order it. I said, yeah, the producer ordered it, and it'll be here tomorrow. Well, this fucking, excuse my language, you can edit out, this fucking thing turned up, this fucking old tambourine with no skin on it. And I just said, how much did that cost? I said, I could have bought one, I could have bought one and survived on for the next year on the money it cost to bring the bloody thing here. But, you know, we were so green, we thought, oh, this is what the big bands do. They fly tambourines around the world. So we got this bloody tambourine. And then I approached the producer, and it was all in good faith, because he actually knew much more than we knew, because we were pretty green. And I said to him, you know, I started questioning him about, you know, why are you doing this and why are you doing that, thinking I was quite clever. And he said something or other to me, like, in front of the rest of the band, which is a real put down, how many hit records have you been on? And I said, well, none. In fact, I've never made any. I've never been near any. And he said, I've been on loads. And I said, yeah. He said, so is this tambourine. So I said, right. So what does that mean? He said, sir, just shut the fuck up until you've been on loads. It was with your tambourine. So, you know, I went, fine. Go ahead and record your tambourine on my record. That was kind of the crux of, like, and we were just like, we'd go, if they said, like, you know, paint your face green and wear short trousers, we'd have done it, because we thought, well, this is, you know, these people know better than us. They've had hit records with tambourines. Right. They fly around the world, so let them do it. So that was kind of, you know, we were easy going in the early stages, and I was, and then you stop being quite so green after a while.
But so, even with the lucky tambourine, that record wasn't a hit, right?
I see the bill. You know, we released this, that, and the other, and we had some high powered people kind of there, and then we never see any money. And at the time, you know, I was sessioning, doing loads of sessions with people, not getting any money for that either. And you just thought, oh, this is what people do. They play free sessions for everyone, and they fly tambourines around the world, and they do this, and you've not got any petrol to put in your car. In fact, you've probably not got a car most of the time, because it's broken down, you can't afford to repair it. But nonetheless, you know, we thought, well, this is what you do, obviously. This is how it works. But needless to say, we found out eventually, to our own cost, that wasn't how it worked at all, along with a lot of other mistakes along the way. You know,
do you know which song the tambourine was on? Or
I'm not going to say, because it would, you know...
Oh, it would give it away.
We're probably not on the best of terms anyway, but I don't want to make it... No, I don't want to ruin his Christmas, so I won't say anything. But let's just say, you know, I'm not using any more bleeding tambourines again. Yeah. That's for sure. It kind of put me off tambourines. Let's put it that way. So every time I hear a tambourine, I turn the radio off, or the record off. But there was loads of escapades like that in the slow burn days, because we were just a bunch of guys that were doing it for fun, that thought we'd like to get somewhere, we'd like to, and we'll do whatever it takes. You know, if they say chew your arm off, we'd start chewing. Is this which arm?
Yeah,
we'd say.
Right.
You know, so we'd do what we thought was the right thing, because we thought the people that were, and there were lots of them over a period of time, were guiding us, obviously got to their positions through knowing what they were doing. But then you find out after a while that most of what happens in the music industry is luck. And nobody knows what they're doing until they've actually got there. You know, once they've, you know, they've got to the destination, their journey, then they know. But on the journey, they don't know. It's like that Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid film, you know, when they're looking after the money, you know, Paul Newman and
Robert Redford, yeah.
You know, they've got no money, and they're on their mules going up the hill, and Robert Redford is all twitchy with the guns and that, and Paul Newman says, you know, going up the hill, we've not collected the money yet, no one's going to rob us. That's kind of explains it all, you know.
Yeah.
So, slow burn went on and on and on, and in the end, I just thought, fuck, I'm going to be in slow burn, I'll be 112 years old and I'll still be in the band. So I just... But at that time, I said, well, I'm leaving. And the rest of the band said, we'll come with you. I said, shit, I'm sure this isn't the way it's supposed to be. You know, if I leave, then you keep the band. Well, the other guys in the band said, no, we'll come with you. I said, well, then I can't really leave. Fuck, we'll change the name. So we changed the name. So it was the same band with a different name.
Right.
So they said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to write some new songs. Okay, let's get started. So that was kind of funny as well, because we said, well, maybe this is the way it happens with bigger bands. Yeah. One person leaves and the rest join him. So, you know, we really didn't have a clue. We could play, but we didn't know what day it was. You know, we thought the weekend was every day. So,
there was just a really wide variety of styles with all the different slowbone songs. Some of them were pretty heavy.
No.
At one time, we had a guy, again, I don't want to use names, but a guy, he's dead now, but a guy that was very well connected, and he turned up to see us, and I don't know how to tell you this story, it's too much to tell anybody, because I don't want to, you know, piss anyone off either, but he turned up and said, oh, you know, I can do this and I can do that, I can move the earth off its axis for you. We went, great, do we need to use the tambourine? No, okay, we'll do it. So he said, I can do this, this and this, but there's just one thing. And so, what's that? Well, you know, you've got to change everything, the way you look, the way you sound, and the way you said, well, then why do you want us? Why don't you get someone that's not us?
Right.
That's the case. So then he said, you've got to change this. So we said, all right, yeah, we'll do anything. It's kind of like, you know, if you keep using the same numbers for the lottery, you won't know if the other numbers have got a chance of winning. So he said, yeah, all right, yeah, we'll do it. So, and that was kind of our way. If someone had said, come and do this, you know, shaved the keyboard player's eyebrows, we'll say, well, will it help? Say, yeah, let's get going, let's do it. We'll do whatever it took. And we did, and that's, hence the changes. Someone had come into rehearsals and said, I've got this great idea. I've just seen this band doing this. Let's try it. We go, okay, great, let's try it.
Right.
Without any thought, really. So it was funny, really. So the poor old audiences, you know, we had this following, they'd follow us around, and we'd say, oh, we've changed our name, we've all cut our hair, and, you know, we're coming out on dressed up as Coco the Clown or whatever it was, you know. Why are you doing that? Saying, well, that's what they do. That and tambourines are the new thing. So we changed a lot. Yeah, we changed a lot. And then that formed into the Roll-Ups.
Yeah.
Roll-Ups did an album, which we changed our musical style, and we changed the way, changed everything, really. And then, you know, the problem with me was also I'd always get cold feet. Once something started getting good or getting somewhere in the later years, I tend to think, oh, it's time to move on. I've got no idea why either, but I'd move on for my own projects or for my own whatever I was doing and just say, I don't want to do this anymore. So
right.
that kind of, you know, manifested itself into the Roll-Ups. And then Lee Hart and the Roll-Ups, on the advice of a management I signed to, that were also managing Judas Priest and the Tourists, who then became
Eurythmics,
and a bunch of other people. So they wanted to change to Lee Hart and the Roll-Ups. And then they said, we're going to drop the Roll-Ups, just as the Roll-Ups were getting incredibly popular. So, and we want a new band, but then the band wouldn't go. So this management company said, we've got your keyboard player. I said, great, okay, what about the rest of the band? And they said, well, you'll have to get the other guys in because they won't leave. Well, then why did we change the name? So it started all over again. Then they said, we're going to put you on tour with Judas Priest. And they'd already manufactured us into something totally different. So, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. So in the end, I said, oh, fuck, you know. Okay, then they said, so we're just going to be Lee Hart. Okay, I'll just be me. So I was me. And then I thought, fuck, I don't want to do this anymore. So I decided to leave myself. We were having like a farewell gig, and to cut a long story as short as is possible, there were four guys watching me, you know, just watching everything I did throughout the show, and they were dressed kind of glam rocky. You couldn't really not notice them because the way they were dressed, and unlike, it was a heavy metal kind of gig. And the guys had all their hair sticking up and makeup and, you know, the tight leopard skin trousers and everything. And when we come off the road, he said, those guys want to see you. And I said, what they want? He said, oh, they want to see you about some business. So cut a long story short, I see them and they told me who they were. And they said, we want you to join our band. And I just said, no way. There's no way I can't play that kind of music. And I'm not going to say who they are either. But they said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I just can't do that. And I said, we're going to Japan in 2.5 weeks' time and then on to Thailand. And I said, okay, I reckon I could do that. So I turned up to have a jam with them the next week. And they weren't very good, to put it mildly. I'm being kind by saying they weren't very good. So they said, what do you think? And I said, well, you know, you can't play all that well. You look great, but you can't play. I said, and quite frankly, you need another drummer. So they said, all right, give us a week. So I gave them a week, and they rang me up, and they said, okay, can you come down for another jam with us, because we've got another drummer? So I said, oh, okay, all right. and we're going to Japan in a week and a half if you're going to join. Okay, so I turn up this rehearsal room, and when I walk in, they're already playing, and there's two drummers, the original one, and another drummer. But I meant you got to get another drummer.
Yeah, a different
the other
drummer.
One ain't good. So now they've got two bad drummers, so it's twice as bad as it was. But there's about 10 days to go before Japan, and I just thought, well, I'd never been to Japan. I always wanted to go, and I thought, shit, it's better to go with two bad drummers than not to go at all. That was kind of my theory behind it. And they said that, you know, if you join, we'll get the photos done now, with da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and it'll all be sold out. Great. Okay, let's do it. I'll teach the drummers to play on the plane. And the next thing I know, I'm in Japan, and yeah, sure enough, the whole tour was sold out. But what they failed to tell me was that there wouldn't be any guys at the shows. It was like 5,000 to 8,000 screaming girls every night. So that was an eye-opener, but it opened a lot of doors, and, you know, things kind of moved on from there. It kind of made me look at the business in a slightly different way. You know, you can plan things, and all your plans don't work out, but if you're in the right place at the right time, luck can see you through sometimes.
And,
you know?
And what year was that when you joined the band with two drummers?
I'm not saying, but okay. You know, let's put it this way. There were humans on the planet at the time.
And did this band go on to be well known?
Well, yeah, but you're still not going to get it out of me. you can research it, but you know, it was after the Second World War for sure. But you know, I did that, and I got a lot of shit from press back home about it. But in all fairness, it opened up doors that I could never have opened at that particular moment in my life, and stood me in good stead for, I'd say, the best part of 20 years mm-hmm. to move on to other places. So the doors that it closed were doors that were pretty hard to open anyway, but the new doors that it opened were, you know, just a new world to me, and it just made me look at things in a different way, and it stopped me being quite so green. I started to go a kind of off blue, which means you're still green, but you understand some of it. So, you know, it was good. Then through that, I got to work with a lot of people, got into production, got to writing for a lot of people. I got approached by a lot of companies in Japan that had, you know, that had American outlets as well. And they were saying, will you write for us, and will you produce, and will you engineer, and will you play guitar, and will you play banjo, or, you know, whatever. And it was then that things started to take off. I come back to the UK, and within 3 days of getting back to the UK, I had four record deals. And then, I wasn't quite so green. So I said, I'll sign all of them, but non-exclusive. And in those days, no one knew what it was, but I'd been told what it meant in Japan. And they all said, yeah. So I had three record companies bringing out three records under three different names. And I thought, Christ, this is, you know, this is working. I didn't expect this. But again, it's that thing of luck, you know, right. Having the luck to go to Japan and then meeting people out there and people explaining some business to me. And then I got myself a Japanese management while I was out there, and a Japanese publishing company, and then they had outlets in America and Europe. And, you know, I came back, you know, with a slightly different outlook on things, and without saying, oh yeah, I'll try that, I'd say, no, I won't try that, I'll do it this way, but I'll let you have it no exclusive, or I do it as a session, or I do this. And again, it opened more doors. It kind of really opened up my eyes to the way you are supposed to do things in the music business, apart from the luck element. And here I am.
Well, so when you were in Slowbone, there was the pub rock movement going on. Like, were you aware of the whole pub rock thing at the time?
I suppose so. But the truth is that every band, whether they want to admit it or not, most of the bands played in pubs at some time. I mean, I remember I went to see AC/DC years ago in right. Fulham in a pub.
Right.
That was with Bon Scott. Yeah. And I was there. Funny enough, I was there with Paul Di'Anno when we were competition and hated each other. But, and everyone else was there watching. But it was a tiny little pub. And then I think they played after that in Islington. But they were playing. So everyone played the pubs, but you didn't think of it as a... You just thought, well, we play the pubs because this is our bread and butter sort of thing. This is what we do. If someone offers you to play in the road, you play in the road. Fortunately, they didn't. They offered you to play in a pub. And that's got a roof. So, you know. And some electricity, so that's a bit easier. So yeah, we were aware of it, but you didn't think you were part of it. You didn't see it as a movement or anything. It was just somewhere you played.
That was sort of what evolved into the punk scene then a few years later, right?
Yeah. Funny enough, when I did a at that time, it was really around about the time towards the end of Slowburn, I started getting lots of session work for a lot of people, and some of the stuff was good and some was absolutely terrible. But I remember I did a one album for Joan Jett, which was Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. I did the guitars and backing vocals on that, and I did that with two of the guys from Blondie and two of the guys from the Sex Pistols, and we right. all got credits on the album. So that's, you know, I was then in from the heavy metal background, but playing with two guys from Blondie and two guys from the Sex Pistols on, you know, Joan Jett's album, and I was from a heavy metal background. So that basically says it all. You know, it was all, everything was ongoing then, so to speak.
Yeah. And like, you know, when the your Slowbone singles came out in like 74, obviously that's when glam rock was absolutely huge over there. And there's the one single, Oh Man, that you guys did, that's a very glam rock sounding song.
You know, we had different producers and different engineers and different arrangers and different record companies and different managers. And I got to the point, I can't even tell you half their names. You know, when it gets to like, you've had like 50 different managers and, you know, 60 different producers, in the end, you'd say, well, I don't know what I was doing. You just say, fuck, I can't remember most of it, you know. Some say do this, and you'd say yeah. Like I was saying before, we were always open to try what we were told, because we thought this is what you're supposed to do. The people that are telling you, you know, they're obviously telling you for a reason. So we did a lot of things, but we obviously made a lot of mistakes and lived to regret it. But yeah, so there was a lot of changes, but variety is sometimes the spice of life. You know, if you keep playing the same riff over and over again, you'll be the best person playing that riff, but you'll miss all the other riffs. So there's fors and against, you know.
Well, I love that song, Oh Man. I think it's great. And it fits right in with the whole glam rock thing at the time. It's just as good as most of the other stuff. You know, they call it junk shop glam. Have you heard that term?
No, because when I think of glam rock, I think of when I was in Japan, and I think probably about the time that I was joining Fastway, about 87, when glam rock was kind of a big thing, and it was kind of creeping into mainstream rock. That's what I think of glam rock. But now I understand what you mean, glam rock being the old bands like Royal Woods Wizard and Slade and that
right,
kind of
right.
You know, and that was just looked upon, as far as I was concerned, on musicians as pop. But I suppose in retrospect, it was glam rock.
Right.
Yeah. So, but you know, that seems like two lifetimes away as well. So three lifetimes away.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of an explanation of what went on up until the Japan era. And then I was doing so many things, I can't even remember most of them. I bought records out under so many different names, some I can remember, I suppose I want to remember it, some I don't. I mean, I did, for instance, I did Bronze Records, which was Jerry Bron, rest his soul, he's dead now, but Jerry Bron, I did a non-exclusive deal with him for a band called Small Lads.
Right.
And they were kind of comedy things. It was kind of like a Madness thing.
Yeah.
And we had a couple of minor hits with that. Bronze Records, and then I did some solo records for him. I did some solo records for Polydor at the same time, and I did some solo records for Island Records, and I had them all under different names, and after time I couldn't remember what I was doing, because we'd also starved for so long, you know, in the initial days you're just starving, you know, sharing out a beer and a sandwich between you, that if someone offered you a bit of money and you could get it non-exclusive, you just say, yeah, I'll do it now. I've got three more lined up right behind you. Let's do them all. You know, because you were hungry. Not hungry for success, hungry to eat.
Right.
So many records come out. Sometimes people, especially I've just come back from Japan, there was one guy turned up with all this old stuff, and some of it I've never seen, and I was just laughing, saying, how the hell did you get hold of all this stuff? And some of it, there's a couple that I'm just so embarrassed about, but you've got to laugh, because I just think it was part of growing up. You know, you're a starving musician, and someone says, do this, and you've not got the train fare home, and you say, shit, yeah, okay, I'll do it now. Where's your money? So, what can you do?
What were some of the other things you put out around that time of the Small Ads? Do you remember, what were some of the other names you went by, or...
Well, I did Summers Lee Hart, I remember, which is me.
Yeah.
I remember I did some with Polydor. I did a load of Japanese stuff. I did some Japanese solo albums. I did some albums in Thailand. I did a couple of number one hits in Thailand in those days with WEA.
And this is in the 80s?
This would be about, it's hard to remember, about 19... I can't remember.
Is this before Yeah Yeah, though? Or
this is all before then.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my old managers recently told me, in one way or another, not my albums necessarily, in one way or another, I'd appeared on or been involved in just over 130 albums in my career. So it's kind of hard sometimes.
Wow. Yeah.
Then there were singles. There was so many singles, I just can't remember them. And some of them are sessions. I mean, I did a lot of stuff with different people, well-known bands as well, you know, and it's hard to rack your brains and keep up with it. And I'm not one of these people that's going to collect all of my stuff and, you know, bring it out to show it to grandchildren, because it's just not me. So it's like, as I said, I was in Japan the other week, and this guy, a few guys turned up with all this stuff, and I'm like laughing, thinking, how the hell did you get this stuff? I mean, I've never seen it. I didn't even know it was out.
Yeah.
And they'd just... looked into my background and found this stuff, and I just thought I didn't know you could even get copies of this stuff. I didn't know it was even manufactured. So, you know, yeah. Next question.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the Bridge House scene. So the Roll Ups played there a lot, right? And Iron Maiden played there a lot, right?
Yep.
And then the whole mod scene was really big there too, right? Did the Roll Ups kind of fit in with the mod thing that was going on?
What happened was the Roll Ups decided, I don't know what we decided, we managed to bridge a gap between what we were and what we people thought we should become. So we found a way of kind of getting in the middle of it all.
Right.
And we just come off, well, we're just coming off of going on to the management with the management that had Tourists and Judas Priest. I can't remember, but you know, I remember when they took us on for management, they brought us in the office one day to meet a hairdresser and to meet a clothes designer and whatever. And I just said, "Oh, great!" And I said, "Well, you know, who are they working for?" And he said, "You." I said, "Me? Us? What do you mean?" He said, "Well, yeah, they're going to get you, knock you into shape." I said, "Well, you know, I play guitar, actually. You know, I'm not a fashion model."
Yeah.
You know, so he said, well, the next thing we knew, it was like, well, these are the girls that are going to take you out to buy your clothes, and this guy's going to do this and that. And we were like, well, this must be what everyone else does. We better do it. Of course, if we do this, things will happen.
Right.
So we did it, you know. But so with the Roll-Ups, yeah, we kind of found a happy medium.
Well, there was
the Bridge House thing was a good scene. It was part of really the pub rock thing, and the guy that was putting that together, he had his own label, and we did. I think we did a live album for him, and then we did a studio album which we owned, and he put a bit of money into. And to cut a long story short, what happened was the Bridge House become Bridge House Records,
right.
And it was a nice setup, but they wanted. They were offered record deals that were really the only way they could get the record deals to take on their catalogue was if our band, the Roll-Ups, were involved in it. So I've come across this a lot of times before in my Fastway days as well. It's like, you know, if you let us sign up Roll-Ups, we'll take on the rest of your product, which put us in a difficult situation because, you know, we were popular and we were the ones that had the material, but we didn't want to sign with the rest of these bands and with the rest of this setup, because, you know, we've made enough mistakes as it was in our career, and we didn't want to be tied in with something that we weren't sure of.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we just said, no, we can't commit. We can let you release this record or you can do whatever, but we can't commit. And then I believe through that, they didn't get their record deal or record deals that were offered because we just didn't want to do it. And it kind of left a nasty taste in a few mouths. But, you know, sometimes you've got to do what you got to do. And you get one chance and you got to take it. And subsequently, some of those songs that we used for the era that were presented as songs, we used those as demos to go on. And they opened doors that just unbelievable doors. But we wouldn't have opened those doors, and I wouldn't have opened those doors, had we just committed to Bridge House Records and just said, yeah, take it, we'll sign to you. I wouldn't be here today with a career. I wouldn't have had the career I'd had. I'd have still been playing the pubs.
Right.
So, and a lot of the bands that were in the pubs then are still in the pubs now. I mean, they just never, you know, they never went on, or a few of them got out and did a few things and they went back to the pubs. So, you know, we were right in our assumption, if you do this, you'll stay here. That was kind of what we said. We had a meeting. We just said, you know, if we get tied in with this, that's what all we'll ever be. If we want to move on and have a career, we got to think a bit different. And for once, we made the right decision that time.
Yeah. Yeah. So, there was the compilation album on Bridge House that had two Roll-Up songs, Everybody's Gotta Have a Hero and Handy Shandy. And those two songs almost sound like they would have fit in with the new wave of British heavy metal that was happening. Right.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. Because we were playing all over. We were playing everywhere we played. There'd be queues down the bloody road from the morning and afternoon onwards. And we were kind of giving off that kind of vibe.
Right. This is called Everybody's Gotta Have a Hero.
Johnny hasn't got a name. He ain't got any insane. He's just living in the shadows of a star. But Caddy Sally won a jubilee. She took a kiss from Alan B. She's just living in the shadows of a dream. Everybody's gotta have a hero. Everybody's gotta have a star. Everybody's gotta have a dream to dream. Song is Taylor, she gave me a picture. Like a band, does it give a damn? She ain't kidding, but she's not another man. She's just where another wins away. Everybody's gotta have a hero. Everybody's gotta have a star. Everybody's gotta have a dream to dream. Song is Taylor, she gave me a picture.
It was kind of like, you know, the heavy metal thing was, I mean, Paul had done well with it, Paul Di'Anno with Iron Maiden,
right,
the way they were presenting themselves. But generally speaking, a lot of bands were looked upon as, you know, that's yesterday. And so you had to find a way to bridge the gap. So we were kind of doing that then as the roll-ups, you know, trying to bridge the gap and appeal to a wider audience, really. We were basically trying to keep the audience we had, but appeal to a wider audience. And that wider audience didn't want to just hear hard rock and heavy metal. They want to hear something with a slightly different edge to it, and that's what we tried to do at that particular period. And hence we got incredibly popular and loads of record deal offers, but we just happened to bring out some different things with that Bridge House set up, and it just didn't work for us, you know, them trying to tie us into a record deal. We just didn't want to do it, you know. And as I said, subsequently we went on with those songs and used them as demos to open doors with record companies and all sorts of things. And we all went on for years and all that sort of big success through the songs that we were offering at that period.
Yeah, the Roll-Ups album Low Dives for Highballs is more, a lot of people seem to refer to it as power pop.
Yeah.
It kind of fits in with power pop, and it fits in with mod, and some of it almost fits in with the punk scene, and then it's kind of foreshadowing what would become new wave. So yeah, obviously, by the time you made the record, you were kind of looking ahead to see where things were going, maybe.
Yeah, plus by then I was earning a living out of writing songs for other people, and I'd started to get wise as to, you know, what you needed to do to craft a song and how you needed to sell the song. And then one of my main objections outside of playing the guitar was writing and arranging songs that not necessarily for yourself. You know, you know, that would survive time. So it was just as important to me then. It started to be as important to me then to present the songs in such a way that the song will live on when you're long gone. You know, you might be the best guitarist on the planet and playing the best guitar solo, but if you fast forward 30 years, no one will remember the guitar solo or where you were playing. But a good song will live on forever.
Right.
And that was really my pretext then, was, well, you know, we've got to do whatever we got to do to make some of these songs adjustable and livable for future music lovers.
So right, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
hence, you know, not wanting to get tied down in that that thing that was going on in the pubs and culminating around the Bridge House. Although the people that were running it were great people. A guy called Terry Murphy was a lovely, lovely guy and really tried his best to accommodate us amongst the others. But it seemed like we were the band amongst all of them that had four, you know, of the four aces, we had three of them. We were holding them, and you know, we weren't about to let them go, to let everybody else kind of ride on our back, so to speak. And I had a similar thing happen, although I'm not going to say the band because I don't want to get in trouble. A similar thing happened when I was in Fastway, when Fastway got re-signed in America by somebody for a big deal. And we were told, myself and Eddie, we were in America, we were doing promotion in America in 1988 or 89, I can't remember now. And our record had just gone in with a bullet, I think, at number 17. In the Billboard Hot 100. And we were told by the record company over here, by the head of the record company, when he was stoned, don't go in and see the record company out there, and I don't want you talking to them. So, of course, as soon as we got there, we went into the record company and demanded to see the top man and wanted to know what our deal was. And then he said, well, all of the bands that we've signed from this particular label in England were all like metal and hardcore bands, and a couple of them very well known. So they're all signed only on the understanding that we have Fastway. So it was, and we said, well, why don't we have this money for promotion? Why don't we have this and why don't we have that? He said, because we paid the money for you guys to your record label. But in order to get you, we've had to take their whole catalog of all these other bands. I don't know if that makes sense to you. So yeah, we didn't have,
money. Isn't that the same thing you were talking about with the roll-ups?
That's what was going to happen to the roll-ups. Well, then right. It happened to me in Fastway. I got a terrible taste of it because we were there with a record that gone straight in at 17. We were hot to trot in a big, big way. But to take the next step would take a lot of money. But all of our money had been sent to the record label in the UK, and about six other bands were benefiting from the money that was meant for us to be promoting us. Mm-hmm. So that's why they didn't want us to talk to the record company. Hence, we got well and truly shafted, and it really hurt us in a bad way because the money had been taken from us to spend these other bands. And good luck to those other bands, but we got shafted in a big, big way. And that's how we'd seen the roll-ups thing. That's how we'd seen it unfold in them earlier days. But then in later days, I got a taste of it, you know, that I didn't see coming. And it really did hurt our careers at the time, myself and Eddie. And it really put us back in a big, big way. It kind of made us lose faith in everything, in life and music business in general, you know.
Yeah.
So if that explains, it all probably sounds a bit complicated, but my life's always been complicated as far as the music business is concerned. If it's going to be complicated, I'm like a magnet to complicate it. It will come straight to me, you know. So, yeah, I don't know where I was in the rainbow of things of like, you know, where I was in my career, where you and I were talking, but that's where we are now, sort of thing.
Well, yeah, we before Fastway, you had the band Yeah Yeah, which
well, that was an enigma in itself because I don't know what I was in before that. I played in so many bands and so many different things going on. I just get lost. But I got to a point. I'd say it was 83, 84 when I was my hobby then was drinking. I was, yeah. I think I was training to be an Olympic athlete in the drinking section, trying to get a gold medal. So I was drinking, and I was just bored with music business, bored with life. And somehow or other, the only thing that was keeping me together was songwriting. And I had a publishing deal with an American music publishers, and I was writing songs for them. And just for something to do, I decided to try putting a band together, really just to round these songs that I had that weren't rock songs. They were all sorts of things. I was trying to get other artists to cover these songs. And I just thought I'll put something together, my songs, nothing really serious and nothing too good because I couldn't really afford to pay anybody, you know, to pay good musicians. So I had to get what I could. Mm-hmm. And it was really just a hobby as far as a band's concerned while I was trying to push these songs I had and do demos for them. I used to go and do demos and that and just have a few guys around me. In fact, for the demos mostly I was using all different musicians from all over the show, host of different musicians. Some of them went on to do big things, some didn't. And then I got this kind of Yah-Yah thing. It kind of opened up into something it wasn't meant to be. It kind of almost turned into a band. I say almost, it did, but I never really considered it to be a band because it was just a mistake. We ended up with signing to the Scotty Brothers,
yeah.
And we had a manager in America and so on and so forth, and I got a further publishing deal, which was amalgamated with my other then publishing deal. So I was then with Arista for my publishing and Shapiro Bernstein. And all I really wanted to do at the time was just get people to cover my songs, and I was writing all different types of things that weren't suitable for a rock band, where my roots have been hard rock.
Mm-hmm.
That's where my roots have always come from. But the songs that I was writing was just to basically just try and get good songs out there, and certainly weren't hard rock. So this band had come about, and it was really confusing, and I was, you know, trying to beat the world record for drinking. So it was, my mind was kind of pretty muddled up, and the next thing I know, we were in America. We put an album together, which was basically eight demos. Was it seven or eight demos that I'd recorded for other people? And all we just with the guys in Yah Yah, we put two songs or maybe three together. I can't remember from scratch, but the rest were just all my old demos remixed,
okay.
And they weren't even rock songs. So.
Right.
We recorded maybe four songs, I think we might have recorded. Three. I think it was Don't Talk. Can't even remember what the other ones were. But
was Dead Lovers one of them?
Dead Lovers, yeah, that was one, yeah.
Yeah.
There was two, three, I don't know. The majority were these demos that I had, and then we recorded those, and then for somehow or other, that spiraled. Again, it was just one of these things that you wouldn't have expected to happen. That got through the management and the record company, then being the Scotty Brothers. Two of the songs appeared in a film called Revenge of the Nerds,
right.
Which was Don't Talk, which was the single, and I think another song called Are You Ready?
Are You Ready, right. Yeah.
And then 20th Century Fox, that had that film, said they'd pay for us to make a video.
Right.
So here's a band that never played any live shows as a band, and making a video with an album out and everything. Really, it was heading for disaster right from the start, really. And as I said, I wasn't really in a fit state to be going on the road. I was just more interested in putting songs together, and you know, as I said, my roots have always been hard rock, so to actually go and play that music that I'd written for anyone that wanted to record it wouldn't have made a lot of sense. And then while all this was going on, I was probably a bit difficult to work with due to the amount of alcohol I was consuming. You know, we were in America, and they'd pulled out all the stops of the record company. They put us at the Sunset Marquee Hotel, which is really expensive, paying for this and paying for that. They got in a producer to redo this, that, and the other, which was abysmal. I won't say who it is, but it was abysmal. The whole scene was abysmal. And I was going out and meeting Lemmy and all my mates and things like that. And then one of the Yaya band members said, you know, something like, you know, if you carry on like this, we'll fire you because you're too rock and roll for us. We've all got girlfriends and we listen to Mr. Mister. And I remember thinking, what the fuck is this? You know, I think I'd said at one point that I'd liked an Ozzy Osbourne record, and I think they were ready to throw me to the wolves. So, you know, it was like, what the fuck is this? So, you know, I was then thinking, what do you do? And then the manager said, oh, yeah, they're going to fire you. So I thought, oh, fuck it, good, the best thing that could have happened to me. They fired me, and I went back and had to work out a way of getting out of the deal with Warner Brothers, which took me ages. But had I not been in that position, then I wouldn't have got the Fastway gig, which, again, come by accident. Absolute accident, and opened up doors like I wouldn't have believed, only through the Yaya thing falling apart, which I never meant to be anything in the first place. Kind of weird, really, because there was a few good things around the Yaya things at that time, and I believe they went on to make another album and attempted to tour, but, you know, I don't think, apart from one guy in the band, they just didn't have the musical credibility or the material to make that go any further than that. And, you know, it was just through that happening that I got the offer through Jerry Bron's son, who I'd made records with. His son was Richard Bron of Bron's Records, and he was managing a lot of rock bands and working with a lot of different people, including Uriah Heep and Motorhead, Girls' School, load of bands like that. And then I bumped into him in the Marquee Club, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I got fired from a band. You know, I told him the Yaya story. I got fired from the band for being too rock and roll and drinking too much and not having a girlfriend. And I'm basically, you know, drinking. And he said, Fast Eddie, he's been trying to get hold of you. He wants you to join Fastway. And when he said that, it conjured up Motorhead. You know, I'm just thinking, because the last time I'd seen Fast Eddie was in Motorhead, right, with all the hair and the leather jackets, you know, and it's great. I just thought, oh, I don't think I'm ready for it. I didn't think my body was ready for it. And I just said, oh, I don't know, really. And he said, well, have a meeting with him. So he set up a meeting. Eddie invited me out to a restaurant, and I'm sitting in this restaurant, waiting, a really posh restaurant, the Jay Mansfield's old dining table. And all of a sudden, in walks this male model with longish hair, with all this Armani gear on, and this guy, I remember thinking, wow, that guy looks really good, tan, and the right sunglasses and everything. And I'm thinking, you know, this Eddie Clark's really late, he's expecting this guy with all the hair and the leather jackets. It turns out the male model was Eddie.
Right.
He just really got himself together. He looked fantastic, and he came and sat down, and he'd apparently got my new recordings of demos I'd done. He got them from somewhere other and loved them. And he just said, listen, I've been listening to all this stuff. I want you to join the band. I want us to make some music, and I want to use some of these songs. And he said, you know, tell me a bit about yourself. And I told him everything that had gone on so far, like I've just told you. And he said, he had a few names for the people I was working with. He said, he'd just come out of a similar situation of his own band. Right. Where he's drinking, and, you know, it fell apart around him, and da 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 da. And then he said, I've got a film coming out with Ozzy Osbourne's got the soundtrack. It's called Trick or Treat, the film was called.
Yep.
He said, I've got a film coming out, da 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 da, and we've got the soundtrack of that, but that's with Dave, the old singer, who's a great singer. He said, but we're tied down to this, that, and the other. He said, you know, we could rewrite and do this and whatever, but I had a problem then, because at that time I had a lot of companies sniffing around me. It all gets so complicated, all of this. I had a lot of record companies sniffing around me, but I was still actually tied up to Warner Brothers from the old Yaya deal. because we transgressed to Warner Brothers Music for our publishing, and they'd taken on the recording as well, even though I wasn't going to be part of it. But they wouldn't let me out of the contract. So I had to kind of bide my time and pretend not to be in Fastway because I was trying to get out of the contract. And if they'd got wind I was going to be in Fastway, they would never have let me go. Mm-hmm. Because of this vast debt that apparently we owed to them. And another company that was interested in me at the time was Sony, with a guy called, oh, I can't remember his name now, the guy used to be in Spencer Davis. And they were part of the Fastway setup, and Fastway owed them about $1 million. So Eddie said, we can't say you're in Fastway either, otherwise, because Fastway were trying to get out of that deal once this film had come out, Trick or Treat. So I had to be in Fastway, but not really be in Fastway, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because of all this stuff going on. Eventually, I got out of the out of all of my deals, got out of all of them, and Fastway got out of their deal with CBS after the Trick or Treat film had come out. I mean, I remember going to see Trick or Treat with Eddie and having to go in separately in case anyone sees us together. Because they put one of them together, and then I wouldn't get out of the contracts, and he'd be tied to his CBS agreement owing some ridiculous amount. I think it was whatever it was, $1 million plus. So we said, you know, we'd have to sit tight until we get out of all these, and we're clean. We've got no contracts around us. So that was kind of how the Fastway thing came together. Although to get in the band Fastway, I had to go through a special audition with Eddie, which I'll never forget. It was kind of, I didn't play an instrument for the audition. And I told him the story of the yo-yo days and the drinking and everything. And he said, oh, you know, I like a drink myself, which everyone knew Eddie used to like a drink himself. And he said, you know, I've got some people you need to meet and, you know, to make sure you can come in the band. And I can't say who these people are because I'll get lynched, but I had to go and meet Eddie at a bar in London where I had to sit down, and these guys come in. They're bikers. That's about all I can tell you. They come in. And I was a hardened drinker like Eddie. So drinking was our hobby. It's what we did every day. And they said, you know, we've heard about you going to join Fastway and that, and da 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 da. And, you know, we kind of, we've got vested interest in the band, so we're going to sit down and see if you can drink. So I spend the night drinking with these guys until they said, yeah, he's passed the audition. And that's how I got in Fastway. I could drink them under the table, basically, but I got through the audition and joined Fastway.
So you were basically in Fastway before the Trick or Treat soundtrack had even come out?
It was just as it was, yeah, before it had come out. I remember that I went with Eddie to the premiere. It was kind of a music biz premiere. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting there, and, you know, we had everyone buzzing around us because somebody had got hold of some demos that we put together. And this was material I'd held back from everybody. I didn't want to commit to any of the other bands because I figured it was too good to commit to some of these kind of third-rate bands that I'd been working with. So I didn't want to let them have the good material. So we'd made some demos, and then a certain manager had gone round and started playing this to people and not telling them who it was. So there were people buzzing around, but some people had worked out who it might be. So so there was a lot of interest, and we couldn't really make any business decisions because of the big problem that Eddie had with CBS, with the debt that the old Fastway owed, and mm-hmm. the problem that I had, where I was in the process of getting out of my contracts to Warner Brothers, to the debts that some of my old bands, or the old band, if you can call it a band, had. So I just had to, we had to sit it through. We were seeing all this stuff in the press about this, that, and the other. And then the film Trick or Treat came out. And I'd been in the band a long while by then, but I couldn't actually tell anybody.
It's funny because I remember they had a video. Fastway had a video for After Midnight from that Trick or Treat soundtrack. But
that's right.
But Dave King wasn't in the video. They had the guy from the movie.
That's right, because David left. And right. See, at this time as well, Pete Way was in the band as well, but I didn't see Pete. Pete, you know, this was a band of professional drinkers. It was me, Eddie, and Pete Way. Pete was in the band, but they had another problem there because Pete got offered the job with, or he thought he got offered the job with Ozzy. But
yeah.
So he rang Eddie up and said, I can't do Fastway because Ozzy, I'm going to work with Ozzy. Going
right.
on the road with him. But somehow or other, some communication lines have broken down in the midst of a few bottles of Jack Daniels. And so we set about carrying on without Pete. And then Pete came back to Eddie and said, oh, I don't have the job with Ozzy. And we said, well, we've already started now. This machine's already rolling without you. So, you know, we didn't have Pete in the band. You know, we'd love to, but we couldn't because we've already put things in place by then. And we had like a myriad of all sorts of business shenanigans going on around us like you just wouldn't believe what was going on, which subsequently you know came to the head in when we were in America with the On Target album, as I just previously said to you, when we found out that the record company had sent all of our money to the record company in the UK to support all of the other bands. Right. Without our knowledge. So right. You live and you learn. And at that time, to make ends meet, I was doing sessions for Foreigner, Bad Company, Giant, Tommy Shaw, you name it. I'd work for anyone. So I was in the studio non-stop working for practically every major band you can think of, mostly backing vocals, just to keep the wolf from the door, because I was tied to other contracts while getting into new contracts. And you don't get the money till you sign the new ones. So.
And you did the two albums with Fastway, and obviously... You did most of the songwriting on those records, right?
Well, the deal was, in fairness to Eddie, you know, business is business. It's kind of like the old mafia thing. You know, you get a share if you're in it. And I had those songs. I mean, I'd held back some. But every time I'm in a project and I see that it's not going to be going where I want it to go, I'll always hold back the best stuff. And I'd always do that. Someone taught me that years ago. So I'd always keep the best till last. So no one ever got to hear it or see it or know anything about it. So... You know, when I got in Fastway, I had all this material all sitting there that was solely mine, and some of it I'd co-written with other people. So Eddie had taken me a few runs up the ladder, and Eddie was good to me as well, let me say. And therefore, and only fairly so, although I wrote the songs, of course I wrote the songs, and Eddie didn't write them, but I gave him a name check. And the same percentage that I got for the rest of his life.
Wow.
Now, mm-hmm. It may not mean a lot, but it means a lot if one of those songs takes off somewhere. So you get your share of the material in perpetuity. Perpetuity means your lifetime or 75 years.
Yeah.
Is it 100 years now? So, yeah. I mean, I could have stuck to my guns and said, no, they're my songs and it's my name. But you say, listen, without him opening some of those doors, I'd have had to gone in through the windows, which were a lot higher up the building. You know, so it was like, okay, you know, the share the songs, let's share the money and whatever else, you know. Although I've got a very funny story, and I mean it in the nicest possible way, because Eddie said to me, yeah, we'll shit, you know, we've got all this equipment, all the Fastway touring equipment was in a warehouse. And so we'd gone down to see it, and there was all these stacks and stacks of equipment and stuff like that. And there was a band car and all that stuff. One day Eddie said, oh, we've got, you know, a bit of short cash. We've got to sell some of the band equipment, which turned out to be all of it. So he said, do you know anyone? I said, yeah, I've got some friends in a band called the Choir Boys who were just kind of getting ready to take off then before they met Sharon Osbourne as their manager. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, maybe they're going to be doing Top of the Pops soon. They could do with some stuff. So he ended up selling them most of the back line, and two of them were good friends. And then I said, oh, how much did we make, Ed? Oh, we didn't make anything. Oh, why is that? I had debts to pay. It was like, oh, right. Oh, I thought they were, it was our equipment. Well, yeah, it is our equipment, but I sold them. It's like, oh, okay. So, you know, you give and you take. But Eddie, as I said again, he opened some very tight doors for me. So, If he hadn't have done that, I wouldn't have opened them until a bit later. I'm sure I would have opened them, but it would have just taken me a bit longer to scale the walls to get in through the windows. So, yeah, you know, I did write the songs, and I produced the albums as well, and the same thing again. I gave Eddie a credit for the production. Production mm-hmm. was my thing, and writing the songs was my thing, and sessioning was my thing, whether it was guitar or vocals or whatever. But it was only right that Eddie should get it, because Fastway was Eddie's baby, still is, mm-hmm. and... We did the two albums, and then some years later, I think it got to Eddie a bit that he'd not done what he wanted to have done on those albums. And he said, look, I'm going to go in and do a reworked version of those two albums, called it Reworked. Would you come in and sing on it for me? I said, yeah, of course I would. So he brought out a third version of one of the albums with, I think, a bit of one of the second album in there with it, to do it the way he wanted to do it, and which was only right. And, you know, I reciprocated by saying, yeah, you know, what do you want me to do? I'll do it. So there was really three albums with Fastway.
Right.
So good days, but a lot, you know, some daisy days, if you know what I mean, in as much as we were, by now, we were both, you know, professional, hardened drinkers. You know, you couldn't get people in bands like that. You didn't get two in a band. You'd always get one, but you got two in a band. So it was kind of hard getting things together sometimes.
Yeah.
But a lot of fun was had. And some of the craziest things in my life happened while I was in Fastway. You know, things I couldn't even repeat and could write a few books about. But also at that time, because I'd done a lot of sessions as well, I was producing a lot of albums for other people and flying around the world doing different things with amalgamation of different musicians and things, being commissioned by different companies, different record companies in different countries to do this album, that album. So I was making income out of producing albums and or writing or arranging and TV adverts and anything else you name it. So, you know, it was a very, very busy period for me and a really fruitful period as well, which subsequently then went on to me releasing some more solo albums off the back of that. Because even in the Fastway stuff, and I was in Fastway, I've always had this thing of hold back your songs, and I'd hold back even more songs that I didn't want to give to Fastway because I thought, well, these are too good for Fastway. So I held the whole Trapped album. I had that with a guy that I co-writer with me. We wrote that before I even joined Fastway, but I just didn't want to play it to Fastway because I thought, I'm going to need these somewhere along the line. And then when Trapped came out, I had another three albums that were written and put by that I didn't want to put into the Trapped format, even though it was only me as a solo act.
Right.
Because I thought, you know, this is too good for Trapped. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but it's kind of like Squirrel, you know, hiding back some nuts for, you know, for supper time, around lunch hour.
And so, the Trapped came out in what, like 91? I think.
Yeah, by the time Trapped came out, I was really unsure about the music business. Again, I think I'm probably going on too long and talking too much, but
no.
I realized at the end of Fastway, I realized in 1990 that it was all over. Basically, you know, unless you were in a first division band or about to take off in a first division band, the kind of genre of music that I was trying to be in and project and be part of, I realized that it was over. It was, you know, there'd still be dinosaurs on the planet, but there'd be in much fewer numbers. That's the way I was looking at it, like the old black and white TV.
Mm-hmm.
You just, I'd met a guy that was a manager of mine in Japan, and he was telling me the shape of things to come, and I was just like, well, if this is what's going to come. I mean, he was telling me this in 1989 about downloads and everything, and I just thought, shit, if the Japanese know this now, we're doomed. So when I'd made Trapped, it was almost like a swan song of sorts, in as much as I'd then decided that within the next couple of years, you know, my performing days would be over because there wouldn't be any point unless something took off, you know, to such a degree that, you know, I was in the first division and I wasn't, and I didn't get to the first division. You know, when I say first division, that's comparable to British sports football when we have the first, second, third, fourth, fifth divisions. You know, I always consider myself to be in the bottom end of the second division. So that's the way I was looking at it. And so I did that really for myself. And it sounds insane, but I didn't want to sign it to a big label and have all the hoo-ha and go on the road, because my mind had been turned as to what future lied ahead for me and others with respect to the music industry and performing live, you know, albums and so on. I just thought, I'll just give it to a little label, and it's just for me, and then maybe I can, some of the songs on there, people will cover them in the future, and that'll be part of my pension. That's the way I was thinking. So right. I turned down some big lucrative offers to go with a small unheard of label so that I could control it, and I wouldn't have to do what I was told and go on the road and do this and do that. I just thought, that's not what I'm doing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So whether I did the right thing or not, I don't know. it obviously held the record back, but that's what I wanted, and that's what I got.
Well, Trapped is a great record, so...
Yeah, it's kind of like an underground record. A lot of people have compared it to the Hughes Thrall album, in as much as, you know, a lot of people got copies of it and liked it, but it didn't get where it should have got. But I've just told you the story for that, so that was kind of the thinking behind it, you know.
Yeah. Well, so, and it really just follows in line with the Fastway albums. I mean, I was saying Yeah Yeah, and you were calling that band Yeah Yeah, so I guess I've been mispronouncing it, but... I mean, if you look at the hard rock songs on that, like Don't Talk and Dead Lovers, then the, you know, On Target sounds just like what you might have done as the second Yeah Yeah album, really.
Yeah.
Especially like Two Hearts and These Dreams. I mean, you can really tell that those are Lee Hart songs, you know, when you hear them.
Yeah, because, well, I was formatting everything while I was in those bands. I was already formatting ahead, like I always do, but I just wouldn't, you know, I didn't see Yah Yah as a career. I didn't see it as a band that was going to last more than 18. I didn't see it as a band, but I didn't see it as anything that anyone would remember. It was just, for me, originally, it was just a vehicle for songs that I wasn't going to record myself, apart from the ones that we recorded as a band, if you like, you know, the two or three songs, I can't remember how many it was. So I'd already had the nucleus of the Fastway already back then, you know, I already knew where I was going, I already had bits of Trapped back then. I was always working, planning ahead. So yeah, I suppose in retrospect, that's why some parts would make you listen to, you know, the tail end of that band into Fastway and see that the songs are coming from the same person or the same area, sort of thing.
Right. And then, you know, on Bad Bad Girls, there's songs like Body Rock and Miles Away that are very much in the similar style.
Well, Body Rock, Miles Away, I actually wrote them 10 years before that came out.
Right.
I wrote them 10 years ago. I've actually got the publishing agreements that I signed to Shapiro Bernstein, and I think I signed, for instance, She Won't Rock. I signed that in 1980 to Shapiro Bernstein.
Wow.
1980.
Wow, yeah.
Body Rock, that was written in 83, 84. So... You know, I'm sticking by my guns in as much as, you know, some of that stuff was around the era of the yo-yo thing and whatever, and there was other stuff as well, but I've always worked ahead and always kept myself to myself and hidden away what I think will, once one door closes, open another door.
Right.
You know, I'm not the only person to do it. I know other people that do it as well, but, you know, sometimes in this business you don't know where your next meal is coming from and you've got to kind of plan ahead. And also, sometimes this business, you do things you don't want to do, whether it's working with people you're not really sure of, but you're in that situation there and then, and you've got to think of, well, okay, you know, a year or two or three from now, I'll be in another situation, and I need to be ready, so I'll be semi-ready, if not fully ready now. And that's where the planning comes in. You know, you can act the drunk while you're really the sharp businessman underneath it, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. And then after Trapped, you did, is it called Ready to Rumble? And
yeah, yeah, so, Ready to Rumble. And then I did Ready to Rumble and another one, which I put out another name called D-Rocks, which was a terrible sleeve, I don't know. But that was called Smart Bombs. So they come out about the same time, Ready to Rumble and Smart Bombs. But you wouldn't know because one didn't come out as me. It came out as D-Rocks.
D-Rocks, right.
I've got no idea why. So that they both come out together, I think, about 2 weeks apart.
You mean... So you didn't choose to call it D-Rocks, do you mean, or?
I don't know who chose to call it D-Rocks.
Really?
Again,
so
somebody said, oh, you've got a picture taken with these people, and I had a picture taken, and then that went on the cover with two girls and two guys, and the guys were about, I suppose they must be 6.5 foot, they're about 6 inches taller than me, and two blonde girls, and then next time I see it was on the cover of this album, and I just thought, what the fuck is going on?
So you mean you signed a record deal as Lee Hart and then they put out a record and called it D-Rocks?
Something like that. Some of it's
crazy when stuff like that happens. Yeah.
You know, you're younger and you're working. I was working my ass off doing different things. You're drinking, you know, you're doing other things as well. And it's hard to keep up with it all because when the work's there, you got to do it. And I've had some points in my career where I've had like 5-6 records out at the same time in 1 month. And couldn't work out how they'd all come out. So, yeah, I remember they both come out. And I think there was something else out at the same time and a couple of singles as well. So,
wow,
it gets confusing. Oh, and they'd brought out, I think the D-Rocks had brought out a single as well with a remix single as well, which was Play That Funky Music and something else, I think. I don't know. I get confused sometimes.
So were the songs that were on D-Rocks, like The Fool You've Left Behind, Turn Our Backs Away, do any of those date back to like the 80s, like when you were saying Body Rock is from and stuff?
Some of those date back to before then, the mid-70s.
Wow. Yeah.
it's kind of, you always have a little bit of something in your suitcase, you know, that suntan lotion, you have a bit more of it because the sun might be a bit stronger the next day and you might run out. You always need a little bit in reserve. And I always worked on that principle. You've got to have something else there, or moreover, a lot more in reserve. But yeah, it's every bit of cloth gets used somewhere along the line. Hence, you know, I've been on so many records and had so many records out because I'd always thought that way, and I didn't think myself as a guitarist or a singer or as a producer or a songwriter or an arranger. I just, you know, as far as the songs are concerned, they were your passport. You know, they were what you were selling. You know, a lot of people will turn out to be a better guitarist than you or a better singer, but if you've got the songs, they will last.
Right.
And they'll get you out of Dodge. You can sell them and get the fare out of Dodge at least. So, yeah. So, that's the story of that. And then, yeah, I think I'd Ready to Rumble, and then I had the Christmas album out. There's a Christmas album which has come out in different formats in different countries all over the world. Jesus Christ, I mean, I can't keep up with it. 9 formats. The Christmas album, that's got me on it, and Eddie and Denny Lane, you know, used to be in Moody Blues, and Paul McCartney's Wings. It's got Guy from the Choir Boys. It's got Steve Overland of FM. It's got Kim McAuliffe of Girls School. It's got, you know, Tim Carter of Saxon, different people. So that came out. But it was about that time I'd already made up my mind that performing was over. I did put another band together, which I just remembered I'd forgotten about, which was with Clive Burr, the drummer of Iron Maiden. Mm-hmm. We put a band together called True Brits.
Right.
And we went to Russia to play one show, which, Jesus Christ, that's like, I'd nearly forgotten all about that. And we made an album, we had a lot of guests on it and things, but it would take me too long to explain about that. But that album came out in Japan on Jimco Records.
Yeah, that has some different singers on different songs, right?
Yeah, and then different companies brought out different versions. And the last I heard, there were 14 different labels with 3 different volumes. And I can't keep up with it. So I really don't know. There was other things like Iron Men came out, and it's just hard to remember because you do things and sometimes you assign something to someone and then they own the copyright, then they can re-release it as many times as they want in any format they want, with any name they want, with any artwork they want. It's hard to tell that to, you know, the guitar player that played the session on it 3 years ago and got his money, and then he says this album's come out, and he doesn't understand about business like I didn't when I was starting out, and you say, look, I don't own this.
Right.
You know, Mr. B from Company C owns this, and if you've got a beef, you've got to go and see him. But you've already spent the money, so you don't have a beef. You signed the contract. But it's difficult, you know, to control things. I mean, as I said then, I'd get all these albums, including the 2 solo albums, and I'd more or less made up my mind I didn't want to perform anymore. And then without going into detail, I'd pretty bad accident where I'd broken my hand and my wrist and my arm. I'm right-handed, and I broke them in a big way. I had to have my hand rebuilt and pinned back together again, and that really was the end of my playing days. I mean, I could still pick up a guitar and play it, but being able to go on stage, whether I wanted to or not, and play after having your arm and your hand rebuilt was going to be a tall order.
Right.
So that also put pay to a lot of things, and out of the blue. Apart from out of the blue getting lots and lots of production work for about 10 years, a guy, an old friend of mine that had come to Russia with me with the True Bits thing as our head of security, was running a load of nightclubs in London's West End. And he said, he's an ex-flying squad police officer, which is a drugs police officer. And he was running all these clubs, and we were good friends. He'd come to Russia with me and Clive, and he said, look, you know, I'm getting out of the club business. And there's 2 clubs in the West End. You know, he didn't own the clubs, he was promoting them. He said, I'd like you to run them. And I said, I don't know the first thing about running clubs. So I haven't got a clue. And he said, well, give it a go. You'll earn money, and it's a different world. So I ended up running, I think, 5 nightclubs in London for a total of about 10 years while I was still doing things in music, mostly producing,
mm-hmm.
Which subsequently led to managing as well.
And Yeah, and you managed Paul Di'Anno.
Paul Di'Anno, yeah, and then I ended up working with other people and doing different things and booking festivals across Eastern Europe. I had a partner, a Polish partner, that was trying to get acts into Eastern Europe. And in those days, at that particular time, it was very difficult. And because I had the contacts through music, you know, through my music career, I could get to people he couldn't get to and twist their arm, you know, and say, will you come and do this festival? And will you do this? Will you do that? And subsequently, I helped him to get MTV into Russia and Poland and things like that. And again, it opened up different doors for me where I could also sell my product as well. So, but it wasn't something I planned. Like most of these things, it was just luck being in the right place at the right time and ending up being a club promoter. You know, just through being in the building at the time when this guy happened to be there and decided he didn't want to do it anymore.
Right.
So that was kind of weird as well. All said and done, the strange thing is now, just come back from Japan and seen some fans out there who've got different records and things like that, and then it brings it back to you that you think, Jesus Christ, all these records and all these different things and things I didn't know about and things I did know about, you think it's a lot. It's a lot. It's more than a lifetime of music. And hard to scratch your head and work out where it all came from. And then the realization that a lot of stuff can now be downloaded from different websites or from iTunes or whatever. And they're all under different names in different formats. And you can't kind of get your head around it all, really. It's everything's changed so very much from when I started out with my banjo.
It sure has. Yeah.
My 5-string banjo. And I forgot to say I have 4 strings on it because one broke in the process of that happens to me for Christmas. So, yeah, things have changed a lot. And I've more or less quit the management now and everything else while I figure what I'm going to do next. I mean, I might just go fishing. I don't know. But as I said earlier, things have changed to such a degree. There comes a point, unless you're really at the top of your game, unless you're Iron Maiden or AC/DC or the Rolling Stones, where you got to say, you know, you got a creaky back and creaky knees, and you know, the guys that used to come and watch you play now are granddads, you know. Yeah. you know where I'm coming from, you know, with bald heads and big bellies, and those chicks that used to come and line up down the front and wait around the stage doors. Well, you know, some of them are in Zimmer frames. All right, that's a bit over the top, but you know what I mean. So you say, well, every dog has their day, and you got to make way for fresh blood. And, you know, you can only look back on it with fondness, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, you definitely should. I mean, you have a great catalog of work that you did in your career.
Yeah,
you should be really proud of, so hopefully you are.
Yeah, I am proud, and most of the time it makes me laugh because I just think, you know, most of the things that I've done, I've just gone and done it without thinking too much, apart from holding back the material for the next venture.
Right.
Just sometimes think, what if? And I mean that in a good way and a bad way, but yeah, I've enjoyed nearly all of it. Nearly all of it I've enjoyed, and there's a lot of names and things I've left out, but you know, you can't get them all in, and some I don't want to get in, and there's a few things I don't want to remember along the way.
Right.
But yeah, I've been pretty fortunate, really.
Thank you.
Okay, so that song we just heard was The Only One from Lee's 1991 album Trapped. That's a great record if you want to try to seek it out. It's out of print. I don't think it's on iTunes or anything, but really good album. And Lee requested that I play that song, The Only One, on the podcast. Really good stuff. I hope you enjoyed that. That was a great talk that I had with Lee Hart. What a nice guy, and what a great story. And as you could tell from listening to the show, what a great catalog of rock songs over the course of his career. There's so much more out there. All those records are great. The Roll-Ups album, Low Dives for Highballs, is great. I love the Ya Ya album called Scarred. And the Fastway records on Target and Bad Bad Girls that he was on. And then his two solo albums, Trapped and Ready to Rumble. And the D-Rocks record called Smart Bombs is really great. So I really hope you enjoyed this, and we'll go looking for some of Lee's music, because it's really quality stuff. And now, to play us out...
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
There are just so many songs that I could play for you here, but I've got to play you another song from that Roll-Ups record that came out in 1979. You heard a song, the first song on the album earlier in the show... song called Blackmail. This is another great song from that album, Low Dives for Highballs by the Roll-Ups. This is a song called It's Up to You. Until next time. We'll be right back.
back.